You know, it's been a few days, not that long a time, that we came together and celebrated the Feast of Trumpets. You know, and Mr. Holliday, as he taught us on that day, you know, it's a time that we look forward to, a time that we look forward to with great anticipation. All right, when we think about what that day means, representing the return of Christ, representing the resurrection of the saints, the transformation of all the first fruits into spirit beings born into the very family of God. You know, what a wonderful time that is. What a wonderful time it is for us to look forward to. But when we look into the Bible, we see that most of mankind, when they hear that trumpet that is pictured on the Day of Trumpets, they won't be celebrating, right? We can read in Revelation 1:7 where it says, "Behold, he is coming with clouds, and every eye will see him, even they who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn because of him. Even so, amen." Right? So we see here, the tribes of the earth will mourn. Or in Revelation 18:11, it says, "And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, being Babylon, who's to be destroyed, for no one buys their merchandise anymore." And then in Revelation 19:19, goes even beyond this morning, and it says, "And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army." Right, so we see here that the majority of the world, right, even if in this reduced state after going through the great tribulation, when they hear that trumpet sound, they won't be thinking about the return of Christ. They won't be thinking about the resurrection of the saints, and they won't be thinking about this transformation of the first fruits. They will be mourning. They will be preparing to fight against Christ, right? This is, you know, not a day that the world as a whole will be looking forward to, right? And if, you know, you can do your own rough math, but you're talking probably well less than 1% of the world, you know, maybe fraction of a percent will actually be looking forward to that Day of Atonement, to that trumpet that sounds on the Day of Atonement. All right, but brethren, what I want to talk today is about another trumpet that's going to sound on this day, sound on the Day of Atonement, that instead of all of mankind mourning, that they will be celebrating, right? That this Day of Atonement, when this trumpet that I'm talking about is going to be blown, all the people of the earth are not just going to be waiting in anticipation, but even after a day of fasting, day of having no food, will not just be waiting in anticipation, but will actually be so overcome with joy that they will be shouting and celebrating. Like, could you imagine if I asked you right now to all stand up and start shouting and celebrating? Wouldn't necessarily be the easiest thing to do, would it? And as we go on and the hours tick by, you know, it becomes even harder, but there's going to be that day that's going to come. Christ himself even talked about this day in his first recorded teaching when he talks about the acceptable year of the Lord, that he had come to proclaim this acceptable year of the Lord, right? So what does rejoicing, shouting, celebrations, the acceptable year of the Lord, the blowing of trumpets have to do with the Day of Atonement, right? These probably are not things that we would typically associate with this day, right? And this is not all that this day pictures. You know, as any of these holy days, there's so many different things that could be talked about. And I was glad as I heard Dr. Merritt talk that he spoke on points that I was reluctant to not speak about but chose not to. So I'm glad that those things got covered. But today I want to talk about these things, some different things that I think put the Day of Atonement into a different light. So if you'll all turn with me to Leviticus 25, verse 8, we'll start reading. So that's Leviticus 25, verse 8. It says, "And you shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years in the day, and the time of the 7 Sabbaths of the years shall be to you 49 years." So at the beginning of this chapter, chapter 25, the Lord had detailed his command for a Sabbath of rest, not for people, not a yearly Sabbath, but a Sabbath for the land, one that was to occur every 7 years, right? And we know that God took this command very seriously, right? This was not a command that was just given lightly, because we can see in Jeremiah and also in 2 Chronicles that this 70 years that actually Dr. Merritt talked about, these 70 years actually came from the land Sabbaths that the Israelites didn't keep, right? So he, even though they hadn't kept them for many years, he ensured the land was able to have this land rest, that it was so important to him. So we see this command of land Sabbaths is very important. And so what it's saying here is, you know, we're going to count seven of these land Sabbaths. And then after you get to this last land Sabbath, the seventh, for a total of 49 years, we can read on in verse 9 where it says, then, so after these 49 years, then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement, you shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land. Right? So this is what I want to talk today about. This trumpet of the Jubilee, this year of the Jubilee that, God commanded the Israelites to keep. Right? And so if we look, in Strong's, and this is H8643, and it's teruah, this word, jubilee, what it means is it means to clamor, acclamation of joy or a battle cry, joy, jubilant, loud noise, rejoicing, shouting, high, joyful sounding, right? So there's no quietness about it. There's no, subdued tones that come with this word. This word is picturing a time of such loudness, but not just loudness for loudness sakes, loudness for the joy that it's going to bring, joy that's going to come. So this is what we're talking about, and it happens on this Day of Atonement, right? And it happens, you know, not every year on the Day of Atonement, not every 7 years, but only once every 50 years does it happen. And then so it goes on in verse 10, it says, and you shall consecrate the 50th year. Right? And so we would see on this Day of Atonement, only once every 50 years after the high priest had gone into the Holy of Holies, when he had sacrificed and made atonement for the people of Israel, that a horn would sound. It would sound on this end of the 49th year and would blow in this year of the Jubilee. And we can read on. It goes on and says, after this 50th year, and proclaim liberty. So this is what this horn is to do. It's to proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, right? So it should be a joyful, loud shouting for you. And each of you shall return to his possessions, and each of you shall return to his family. Right? And one of the first things when I, you know, was reading this and kind of getting into it, one of the first things that I thought about was King David, right, as he was bringing the ark back to Jerusalem. And I'll read it. And this is, I no way saying this was a year of Jubilee or anything related, but how David acts at this time is how I can only imagine the people will act during this trumpet that's going to be sounded. So this is in 2 Samuel 6:14. It says, and this is David bringing the ark to Jerusalem, so a time of great joy for him and for the people of Israel. In verse 14, it says, then David danced before the Lord with all of his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. In verse 16, it says, now, as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, who was also David's wife, looked through a window and saw David, King David, leaping and whirling before the Lord. And then it goes on and says she despised him in her heart. And then if we drop down for verse 22, I think there's another interesting point here. In verse 22, so this is 2 Samuel 6:22, it says, and this is David speaking to his wife, it says, and I will make myself even more undignified than this, and will be humble in my own sight. Right? He's humble in his own sight. He's willing to, you know, dance with all of his might, leap and whirl, looking like probably a fool to some people, or at least this is what his wife thought he looked like, undignified. But he's willing to do this because he was humble in his own sight, and he was so overcome with the joy of bringing God's ark into Jerusalem that he was willing to do this for God, right? And so I can only imagine when I think of this trumpet of the Jubilee, this was the first thing that I thought about. Could you imagine, and as we talk through what happens this day, can you only imagine what people's response will be to this horn that's coming? Right? So just think about different types of people on this day and how they might feel. Right? First, think of the anticipation. You're the 46th Day of Atonement, the 47th, the 48th, right? You're starting to see this time coming ever closer, and how much the people would start to anticipate, right? How much easier would those fasting, those days of fasting get as you get closer and closer to this 50th year, right? And when you think about it, 50 years, right? This will happen, you know, once for a lot of people in their adult life, maybe twice. But this isn't an event that's going to happen year after year. This is something that you're going to look forward to. This has big implications for them, right? Think about that, you know, somebody who's 20-something at that time, whose parents, you know, had sold off their land, and so they didn't have land. And all they had known was perhaps servitude, right? They had been a servant all 20 years. Could you imagine what they would feel like knowing that their children and that they would no longer have to live this life of servitude, that they would be brought back to their land and that they would have something that they could call their very own, right? Could you think about this, that knowing that their children as they're growing up wouldn't have the same life that they had? Or what about a 50-year-old who had never known a time when their family had owned land, had never been around the rest of their extended family, right? What would their reaction be? They had known something their entire life, and now it was going to be different. It was going to be better, right? Or think about, you know, maybe that 80-year-old father who, when he was younger, for whatever reason, he had to sell his land. He had to go into servitude. His whole family had to go into servitude, right? Knowing that before he would die, this trumpet would blast, and he would see his family again return to their land that he had lost, right? Knowing that whatever mistakes he had made, whatever things that he had done to cause that land to be sold, it would no longer curse his family, right? They would have a new opportunity. And then you would have families reuniting, right? This isn't today where you would, you know, fly from one city to another or drive a car from one city to another, right? If families had been split up because they had to sell their land, they had to sell themselves, right? They would be reuniting for perhaps the first time in decades, right? Think of all these different things that would happen on this Day of Atonement when the sound of Jubilee would sound, right? All the anticipation, all the buildup that would happen. Now, this isn't just some minor thing in someone's life. This is something that they would probably have been looking forward to for years, for decades, perhaps, right? So I would, you know, say, and this is why when I think of even as they're fasting, right, even as they might be weak for some time, that when this trumpet sounded, that they would be acting as David did, right? They would be leaping for joy. They would be, you know, crying aloud. They would be praising God for this amazing blessing that God had given to the children of Israel, right? And it doesn't just end with this, right? So we've just talked about one thing out of the year of Jubilee, which is being able to return to your land. But we can go on. We can go on in verse 11. It says, "The 50th year shall be a jubilee to you," right? So in it, you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, neither gather the grapes of your untended vine. So again, this is much like the land Sabbath. So this is another land Sabbath, you could say. And then in verse 13, it says, "In this year of jubilee, each of you shall return to his possession," right? And it says, you know, anything that you sold from your neighbor or you bought, you would return, right? You wouldn't oppress them. You would give it back. Or if you were the one that had sold it, you would have it returned to you. And it goes on and it gives more commands. But then dropping down to verse 17, just again, it talks about, "Therefore, you shall not oppress one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God." And then in verse 18, another command or another promise that actually God gives as part of this command. In verse 18, it says, "So you will observe my statutes and keep my judgments and perform them, and you will dwell in the land in safety," right? Then in verse 19, it says, "Then the land will yield its fruit and you will eat your fill and dwell there in safety." You know, and much like Dr. Meredith said, you know, the Lord doesn't repeat himself, right? There's a reason why he repeats himself. And a lot of times it's to emphasize this point or whatever point he's making. And so we see here twice God reinforces the fact that this will be a time of safety. And at first you might think, you know, that's well and good. You know, definitely we want that. But, you know, think about what's happening at this time and why that's actually such an important promise, right? So think about, from a physical perspective, this would be the prime time that the enemies would attack Israel, right? First, you would have people moving all about, right? You might be moving from the north of Israel where you had, you know, sold yourself into servitude down to the south, or you would move from one place to another, right? So it would be an easy time for enemies to send in their spies to see what the land was like. It'd be an easy time for armies to come in because the people wouldn't be prepared, right? And as we drop down further in verse 20, we can see an even bigger reason why enemies might attack at this time. And then verse 20, it says, "And if you say, 'What shall we eat in the seventh year?' Because they had been told not to plant, it says, and not to harvest, it says, 'Since we shall not sow nor gather in our produce, then I will command my blessing in the sixth year, and it will bring forth produce enough for 3 years.'" Right? So think of this. You know, not only are people moving all around where it would be much easier to attack, but the wealth of the nation would be essentially triple what it normally was, right? They could come in and an enemy could attack and get food for 3 years, right? So this would be a prime target for someone to attack. But God says, you know, no, I didn't give this commandment that the enemy would attack. I'll hold them off. I'll make sure that you're safe. So he reiterates that, you know, not only is he giving this blessing, he's going to give them the protection that they need to fully, you know, be satisfied with this great blessing. And then we can drop down, verse 23, gives, you know, talks more about this redemption of property. It says, you know, the land shall not be sold permanently. And why is the land not to be sold permanently, right? For the land is mine, for you are sojourners or strangers and sojourners with me, right? So the reason why this is to happen is because they are dependent on God, right? This was not land that was theirs. This was land that God had given to them. And so it wasn't theirs to permanently give away, right? Just further reinforcing how much dependence, how much total dependence the children of Israel had on God. And then dropping down a little bit further, and I'm skipping through because I could probably take the whole time just reading these verses, but and there's a lot of repetition in how the commands are given, but dropping down to verse 28, it says, "But if he is not able to have it restored to him," right? So there was a way that even between the Jubilee years that you could redeem back, you could buy back your land. But here is, even if they weren't able to do that, just reinforcing what this day would mean. So, "But if he is not able to have it restored to himself, then what was sold shall remain in the hand of him who bought it until the year of the Jubilee. And in the Jubilee it shall be released, and he shall return to his possession." So just further reinforcing that these things, you know, God at one time across the entire nation had them go back to what he had given them, go back to the blessing, to the land that he had given to them, to them very specifically, you know, not them as the nation of Israel, but you as an individual family, the land that he had given to your family, he was going to return to you, right? He was going to return you to it. And it goes on and gives some commands about whether in the walled city or in villages and these kind of things. But then dropping down to verse 35, it talks about another, you know, blessing that you have. And then there's verse 35, it says, "If one of your brethren becomes poor," right? So if within these 50 years, someone becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger, a sojourner, that he may live with you. You know, and so it says, "Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you." Right? And so this, you know, this Jubilee year, this command around the Jubilee year wasn't just about how God would bless Israel, but it was also about how you were supposed to treat your fellow man, your fellow brethren. And it says, "You shall not lend to him," and this is in verse 37, "You shall not lend to him your money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God." Right? So it reinforces this idea that part of the reason why we are to be kind, to look out for our brethren, is because of how God treats us, right? This notion of God expects us to treat others as he is treating us. And then it goes down and it says, and if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you. So there is, you know, this idea where somebody could sell themselves to you. It says, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave, right? So you aren't to treat your fellow brethren, even if they sold themselves to you, not as slaves, but as a hired servant and a sojourner, he shall be with you and shall serve you until the year of the Jubilee. So again, what I was talking about is, you know, you had sold yourself into servitude. You know, you weren't fully able to be free. You weren't able to do those things that you might want to do. But there was this year that you could look forward to when it would all come to pass where you would be free again, right? You would be free from your debts. You would be free from your servitude. And then it says, and then he shall depart from you, he and his children with him, right? So his entire family shall depart and shall return to his own family, and he shall return to the possession of his fathers, right? And so it shows, you know, not just this kindness that God is going to do for us, or not this kindness that God was going to do for the children of Israel, but also a kindness with which we to have with each other, right? And we're to have that kindness because of what God has done for us. And so it goes on, and I'll skip a few verses and drop down to verse 47. It says, now, if a sojourner or a stranger close to you becomes rich, right? So in this case, it's someone else comes into the land, a non-Israelite comes into the land and becomes rich, right? And one of your brethren who dwells by him becomes poor, and he sells himself to the stranger, right? So in this case, it's not you sold yourself to one of your fellow Israelites, but you sell yourself to someone from another nation. And it says, sells himself to the stranger or the sojourner close to you or to a member of the stranger's family. After he is sold, he may be redeemed again. One of his brothers may redeem him, right? Or his uncle or his uncle's son may redeem him. Or anyone who is near of kin to him in his family may redeem him, or if he's able to redeem himself. Right. And so we see there's this opportunity for you to redeem yourself or someone that's close to you to redeem you outside of the time of the Jubilee. Right. So not waiting for the Jubilee year, but a near of kin could come in and redeem you. Right. And then it says, and it tells how you're essentially to figure out what this price should be for redemption. It says, thus he shall reckon with him who bought him. The price of his release shall be according to the number of years from the year that he was sold to him until the year of the Jubilee. It shall be according to the time of a hired servant for him. So, you know, how this would practically work is, you know, if you sold yourself in year 10 and you had 40 years left, you know, that person would, you know, give some price for those 40 years of labor that you would have. And then if your near of kin wanted to redeem you, he would have to, you know, maybe in year 20. So after you had served 20 years, but you had remaining 30 years, he would have to buy you back for those 30 years that you had remaining, you know, of your servitude, right? And so if it was many years, as we see in verse 51, if it's many years, you're going to pay a bigger price. You're going to, you know, your near of kin is going to pay more to redeem you. But if it's closer to the year of Jubilee, you would pay less, right? And it says in verse 52, towards the end, and according to his years, he shall repay him the price of his redemption. And he shall be with him as a yearly hired servant, and he shall not rule with vigor over him in your sight. And if he is not redeemed in these years, right? If no one could redeem him during this time, then he shall be released in the year of Jubilee, he and his children with him. For the children of Israel are servants to me. They are my servants, whom I brought you out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Right? So we see here that, you know, even if it's someone that doesn't believe in God, even if it's, you know, someone that's not an Israelite, they still have to keep this commandment, right? God is going to make them keep this commandment of allowing you to be redeemed or to, at the time of Jubilee, to be released. Right. So this wasn't something that was, you know, if you were an Israelite, you had to do, but if you're not an Israelite, you didn't have to do. No, this was something God was going to do across the entire land. Right. And so, you know, we see several things in this command around the year of Jubilee, right? And, you know, four, you could say, major themes that we see out of here. You know, first is this notion of dwelling in safety, right? There's kind of no point in returning you to your land if all it is going to be, you know, attacked and taken away by someone else. But God will ensure that you are safe during this time. And of course, it you know, reinforced the fact that this isn't just a blanket safety, right? You still had to obey the commands of God, right? That was still a prerequisite, but that you would, you know, have God's very promise that he would have you dwell in safety. Another theme is redemption, right? You can be bought back. You can be brought out of the servitude, out of the debt that you might have. There would be a returning during this land of Jubilee to both your land and your family, right? It wasn't just necessarily returning to your land, which they would have been, you know, I'm sure, very excited about, but you also be reunited with your family. You would be brought back together. And then the fourth is this notion that, you know, God promises these blessings to you. And in turn, because of what he's done for you, you also have to show kindness to others, right? So it's not just about God one way giving you great blessings and you do nothing in return. You know, God is expecting you to do something in return in these Jubilee commandment. It's to do something kind to other people, to think about other people and what they need, you know, not force them to work, you know, rigorously, right? So if you could imagine if you had a servant in that time, you weren't to, you know, make them work, you know, 6 days a week, 18 hours a day, right? This wasn't how God expected the children of Israel to treat their brothers that might have become poor, right? And so we can see from a physical perspective how great this law is, right? You know, you could see why it's called the trumpet of the Jubilee, ushering in this year of Jubilee. There'd be great joy around it, right? How much celebration and joyful shouting would happen because of this, right? And it's also, you know, a great reminder that whatever the mistakes of our past won't haunt us forever, right? They won't control us. They won't control our destiny, that there's a time, you know, from this physical command that you can then, you know, learn from your mistakes and move on, become free again, right? This declaration of liberty, right? And you can only imagine, you know, if any nation were to keep this law, how different they would be, right? How different, you know, the nation of the United States would be today. We wouldn't have near the issues of, you know, rich and poor and divisiveness is what we have today, right? But, you know, I think we could, you know, stop and just talk about these physical things because they are such a great blessing, right? It would deeply affect whatever nation followed it. But I think, you know, we would be remiss if we only focused on the physical application of this year of Jubilee, right? Because we know these things that are physical, these things that God lays out, as particularly for the nation of Israel, exists to help us understand the spiritual, help us to understand the plan that God has for us, right? The spiritual plan of God, right? And so you could ask a question, you know, why would God have the trumpet of the Jubilee sounded on this Day of Atonement? You know, why not on the Feast of Trumpets? Isn't that when Christ is going to return, right? Isn't that when Christ is going to make everything good, right? Or the Feast of Trumpets is also when you usher in the new civil year, right? So if you were going to make huge changes to, you know, the land and to all of these things, wouldn't you do it on this, you know, civil new year? Why would you wait these days to the Day of Atonement? And I think, you know, these four themes that I talked about from the Jubilee command, I think when we think about them, they tie very directly to this meaning of this day, right? The meaning of the events of this day, and give us a deeper understanding of how this day fits into the plan of God and how we are to think about this day, right? And we focus, and you're not wrongly, because that's what they are, but we focus on certain things. And, you know, this can easily be a day because we're fasting and because, you know, things like Satan being bound and things like that, and sin being atoned, it can somewhat be a negative day sometimes. But what God is telling us is that this day we should be looking forward to. We should be looking forward to with great joy and anticipation, right? Willing to shout with joy during this day because of what this day pictures, right? And so let's look a little bit deeper into how this day fits into the plan of God. And so we'll start off, and I'll go back to the one where Christ talks about this acceptable year of the Lord, and read in Isaiah. And this is in Isaiah 61, verse 1. It says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because of the Lord has anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor." Right? Think about this day of Jubilee. Isn't that good tidings to the poor, that you won't forever be poor, that there's coming a time where you'll be free, you'll have liberty, that you'll be returned to your land? "He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted." You know, think about, as I said, that 80-year-old man who had, you know, potentially done some stupid things to cause him to have to sell his land and sell his family into servitude. Do you think he's brokenhearted about what he's done, or what he would have done, right? And Christ is here saying he's there to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty. Again, this notion of liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison as those who are bound, right? And yes, there's the physical prison, but there's also the spiritual prison, right? The prison that Satan keeps us in, the prison of sin, right? That both Christ in John and Paul and Galatians talk about, that we're all bound to this prison of sin. Right. And then in verse 61, verse 2, it says to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. Right. And in other translations, it's to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Right. Think about this Jubilee. Wouldn't that be a year of the Lord's favor? He's going to help you dwell safely in your land. He's going to give you triple the harvest that you would have normally had. Right. Or another one, the time of the Lord's favor has come. Another, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord, or the year of the Lord's goodwill, right? Think back to that proclamation of the trumpet blowing throughout the land, ushering in this year of Jubilee, this year of good favor from God. And it goes on, it says, "In the day of vengeance of our God to comfort all who mourn." And I think this is another interesting thing, right? You know, isn't our God full of tender mercies, right? He is going to have, yes, a day of vengeance, but when that's done, there's a whole year of his favor, right? Think how much more he gives out in favor than he gives out in vengeance. And then it goes on in verse 3, "to console those who mourn in Zion, to give them beauty for ashes, the oil of joy for mourning, the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness, that they may be called trees of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be dignified. And they shall rebuild the old ruins, they shall raise up the former desolations, and they shall repair the ruined cities, the desolations of many generations." Right? They're going to come back. And this is what this day of Jubilee talks about. You're going to be returned to your land, and think how eager you would be to go and rebuild. Like, if it had only been used for planting, you would go and you would build houses for your family. You would build barns, right? You would go in and you would rebuild because of this new thing that you had been given by God. Right? And so we can start to see how this day of Jubilee, or this year of Jubilee, ties into the fulfillment of God. But I want to look at kind of these four themes, and I want to look at it from the book of Genesis, and how these four themes tie into, even more deeply, what began at the very beginning in the Garden of Eden. And I'll move through this hopefully fairly quickly. But in Genesis 3:14, it says, "So the Lord God said to the serpent," right? So we know Adam and Eve had sinned, and then God comes back, and they're gathered together, the Lord, the serpent, Adam and Eve. And then he starts with the serpent, and he says, "Because you have done this, you are cursed more than all the cattle and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. And he shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." Right? And so when you think back about this notion of dwelling in safety, right, this is how it's going to happen, right? So God doesn't put away Satan just to put away Satan. He doesn't lock him up just to put him locked away. He does it so that we can live in safety during this year of Jubilee, right? The year that is pictured. And so we see that this ultimate fulfillment, you know, is done on this day, as we know, right? We can read in essentially two places where this happens. First, where he's locked away for 1,000 years, and then ultimately when Satan is put away and cast into the lake of fire, right? So we can first read in Revelations 20, verse 1, it says, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released a little time." Right. And then we can drop down a few verses, and it talks about in verse 7, and then this 1,000 years has expired, and then Satan's released. And what immediately happens when Satan's released, right? He goes out and deceives the nation. But then when he deceives the nation, what happens, right? It says the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, they gather them together to battle, whose number is in of the sands of the sea. Right. And it goes on and talks about, you know, in verse 10, the devil who deceived them was cast in the lake of fire and brimstone. And so we see here, right, Satan is put away for 1,000 years. And so the land dwells in safety. But then what happens as soon as he is released? Right. The nations, after 1,000 years of only knowing the rule of Christ, he then comes back and he stirs the nations up. And they're fighting again, right? And so it shows that, you know, for God to fulfill this promise of safety, right, Satan has to be put away. And that's why Satan is put away, right? Satan is put away so God can fulfill his promise of safety, right? And we can see, you know, it's only when he is put away that we are safe, right? And so he does it for our sake, right? The binding of Satan is not an end. It's a means to an end, right? And it's an end that God has promised as part of this Jubilee year. So moving back, so that's the first where we can see, you know, how it ties to this day, right? For the only way for us to be safe is for Satan to be bound and put away. And then moving on in Genesis 3, verse 17. Actually, I'll skip this for sake of time. I'll drop down to verse 19. It says, "In the sweat of your..." So he's talking now to Adam. It says, "In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and dust you shall return." And so here, you know, God is essentially telling Adam that he's going to die, right? He's going to turn back into the physical dust that he came from, all right? And why is he going to die? He's going to die because of the sin that he had done, right? And we all die for the sins that we have done. And so this, you know, second major theme of the day of Jubilee, or the year of Jubilee, is this notion of redemption, right? And this is another theme of the Day of Atonement, right? Where we have all sinned. We've all, you know, had that debt against us. But Christ comes back and atones for that sin, right? And allows us to all be redeemed, right? And if we can look in Matthew, or we'll skip that and go to Colossians 2:13. It says, "And you, being dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he has made alive together with him, having forgiven you all your trespasses, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us." Right? And so we see Paul equating sin with debt, right? And debt, as in the day of the year of the Jubilee, was a legal problem. Right? It's a debt that only Christ could pay off. Right? And so if we think back to this law of the Jubilee, right? For a few first fruits, right? Christ acts as our near kin, right? He redeems us before the fulfillment of the year of the Jubilee, right? And this is laid out in the law of the Jubilee. I think no accident, right? This law points to the fact that if you have a near of kin that has something that's so priceless that he can come and redeem you at any time. And that's what Christ, you know, does for us. And I think it's, you know, it ties this day, you know, and this law of the Jubilee, not just for those who are going to be redeemed as a whole world, but even to us, right? This law allows Christ to come back and pay a high price for us, right? Think of this notion of the further it is from the day of Jubilee, the higher price, the higher the price that the, you know, your near kin had to pay, right? And Christ was willing to pay that regardless of how far it was away from the day of Jubilee for all of us, right? And then, you know, not just for us, but then there's this opportunity for anyone that hasn't been redeemed, that you will automatically, just by being there, you will be redeemed by Christ's sacrifice, right? And we think back to this high priest going into the Holy of Holies and think of Christ. You know, this is the time where Christ brings his sacrifice into the Holy of Holies and from a spiritual perspective and redeems not just those few first fruits that have that God has chosen before, but he redeems all of mankind, right? And now all of a sudden when this trumpet is blown, everyone who has been a servant, you know, or a slave to sin in a spiritual case will all be redeemed and will all be set free, right? This is the liberty that is talked about, right? All at once, all debts, all sins are forgiven, right? Everyone is given a clean start, a fresh start to begin building their relationship with God, right? And then we can move on. So that's kind of the second major theme of how this year of Jubilee ties to the meaning of atonement and why they would be brought together. And then in Genesis 3, 22, the last one, it says, "Then the Lord God said, behold, the man has become like one of us to know good and evil. And now, lest he put out his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. Therefore, the Lord God sent him out of the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. So he drove the man out. Right? He drove Adam out and Eve out of the land of Eden. And he placed cherubim at the east of the Garden of Eden and a flaming sword which turned every way to guard the way of the tree of life." Right? And so we know that God, you know, intended us to live with him. He intended us to be with him, right? To live here on the earth with him from the very beginning. But it was our sin that prevented it, right? It was our debt that caused the sin of Adam that caused us to be removed from this land that God intended us to inherit, right? And so our debts, you know, our sins caused us to be removed. But as the year of the Jubilee pictures, right, there's coming a time when we will be returned to our land, the land that God intended us to inherit, the land that God has individually set for each of us, right? Living with God, right? And also living with our family, the family of God, right? So this third major theme of the Jubilee, picturing the return to our land, the inheritance that we were supposed to have until our debts caused us to be taken away from that land. And then also a return to our family, the family that we were intended to be with, right? And we see this both in a short-term future sense and also a long-term future sense, right? So first, God is going to gather all of the people of Israel at the beginning of the millennium. And we read this in Isaiah 11, 11 and 12. It says, "And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left from Assyria and Egypt, from Pathros and Cush, from Elam and Shinar, from Hamath and the islands of the sea, and he shall set up a banner for the nations and will assemble the outcast of Israel and gather them together, the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth," right? He's going to gather them together and put them in the land of Israel. But even this is just a physical representation of what's going to happen, because ultimately mankind, you know, will no longer be driven away from the tree of life. Right? We will dwell in the land of God, in the land with God, as he's always intended us to. We will dwell there in the land where God is, and we won't ever be removed like Adam and Eve were. And we see this in Revelation 21:1, where it says, "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth have passed away, and there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he shall dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God." Right? So we will be brought back into this land that God has promised us, that is our inheritance, that he always intended us to be. And we will dwell there with our family of God, right? His family that he's building. And so we see these major themes of the Jubilee tie directly to the meaning of this day, right? And you might have, you know, one last remaining question then for this day is, so we've talked about a lot of things, but also a major part of this day is fasting, right? How does fasting tie in with the celebration? Well, I think there's two big reasons why. The first is this fourth major theme of the day of the year of the Jubilee, right? Which is kindness to others. And I won't cover this in detail because Mr. Holliday covered it last year in great depth on the Day of Atonement. But we can look in Isaiah 58 where God talks about the fast that he intends us to have. And we'll just read a couple verses from here. This is Isaiah 58, verse 6. It says, "Is this not the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry?" Right? Again, kindness with others. "And that you bring to your house the poor who are cast out when you see the naked, that you cover him and not hide yourself from him." Right? And so you see this very similar language that's used in both Isaiah 61 and in the commands around the year of the Jubilee. Right? So part of this fasting is that we humble ourselves and we use this as an opportunity not to be puffed up by our righteousness, but to be kind and outgoing concern for other people. Right? To look at what others don't have and see if we can provide that for them. And then the second reason is to humble ourselves before God, right? That we acknowledge that he and he alone are responsible for this great outpouring of blessings that happened during this year of Jubilee, right? And that this day, right, which is a redemption of our past sins, our past debts, you know, only comes from him. And not only that, but once these debts are paid off, that we must stay close to God, right? That we have to work together towards our ultimate goal of eternal life, right? Because think back in this time of Israel. Someone could have come into this 50th year, been returned to their lands, and only in a few short years gone right back to what put them into servitude, right? And so it's important as we, you know, are coming into this great blessing that we don't think that it's because of us, right? That we see where it comes from and what we have to do to maintain this blessing for all eternity, right? And so it's, you know, as part of our spiritual journey, we've been redeemed and the whole world will be redeemed at some point, but we can't use that as a license to go back to the way we were. The things, the thoughts, the actions that put us into debt with sin, right? We have to use this day of fasting where we humble ourselves as an opportunity to break free with God's help from our past and to look forward to how he expects us to think, how he expects us to act. Right. So when you think about this, you know, what a day this pictures, right? We're all sitting here and it's getting later. So we're sure getting hungrier. And as Mr. Holliday throws out more and more, foods that we are to think about, you know, we start to think about that physical food that we might be yearning for, right? We might start getting a headache. Our mouths are getting drier, right? It might be harder to pay attention. But right, we're gathered together today on a day picturing what is the first of God's holy days where the fulfillment will be joyous to all of mankind, right? They don't understand, you know, basically every other holy day that's come before this that they should be joyous. But this is a time the whole world will rejoice, right? We rejoice with loud sounds, with loud joy and laughter. And so yes, it pictures Satan being put away, right? But more importantly, it pictures this proclamation of liberty for all of mankind, liberty from tyranny, liberty from fear, liberty from sin, and ultimately liberty from death, right? Christ will go on this day and make that atoning sacrifice for not just the few chosen first fruits, but for all of mankind, allowing everyone to come into a relationship with God. Right, brethren, what a day this is that we celebrate, and what an awesome God it is that we serve, that he would give us this day to picture his future coming plan for mankind.